So a lot of times, many times, nonprofit organizations describe or frame what they do without a real understanding of how similar they sound to two or three other nonprofits in the community. And so right. When you talk about telling a story, understanding marketing is really a big deal to making sure that you are telling your story in a way, as you said, that's not only unique, but is clear and does away with the blur. Because what philanthropists do when the picture is blurred is just back away.
Welcome to the How Leaders Think podcast, a show that transforms you by renewing your mind and giving you new ways to think. I am your host, Kenny Lang, and with me today is the myth, the legend, Dawn Franks. I'm your hype man, so we'll keep working on that. She is the president, CEO, chief everything officer of Dawn Franks Strategic Solutions. She launched recently a consulting practice to provide coaching and planning for philanthropists and nonprofit leaders, but she comes from 40 years of experience as an executive in the nonprofit world and leading private family foundations, which is no joke. Welcome to the show, Dawn.
Thank you, Kitty, and thanks for giving me a chance to visit with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I figured it's about time, instead of me just interrupting all of your coffee meetings at Panera, that we would have a scheduled time for us to talk. So next time I'm just going to be like, hey, hi, bye, and just sneak out the back door. But I'm excited to have this conversation with you. You are a wealth of wisdom, and having gotten to see you teach, you're at our board retreat, which was really helpful. And I was taking notes, which if anybody knows me, knows I hate taking notes unless something's really good. I believe I can remember everything. And then 15 minutes later, I'm like, what is it that we were talking about? So tell me today, though, what is on your mind?
This is a really interesting time right now for philanthropists and for nonprofit organizations, not just in our local community, but across the entire country.
Okay.
Because there are significant shifts going on in Washington, D.C., administratively, that is impacting funding that's going to travel back toward nonprofits and the work they do. Mm-hmm. And I can explain why that is important for a philanthropist or important for a nonprofit, because they come at it from different perspectives. But it's mm-hmm. a very interesting time that we're in right now.
Yes, I would agree. And obviously has been a topic in different groups that you and I are both a part of. So it's been talked about. I'm curious, number one, set the stage for us on what makes it interesting, what's been the current thinking around grants, government funding, which is very different from private donors or even the like family foundations that you've run. What's happening right now? And then let's get into why that matters and how people can be processing that in a healthy way.
Actually, for my whole career, the opportunity for an organization to apply for state or federal funding has always existed, has always been a challenge. It always takes a certain level of sophistication, maybe is not quite the word, but maybe preparation is a better word, that an organization is prepared at a certain level operationally to mm-hmm. actually be able to handle those funds or to even write such a grant. But it's always been a competitive process, and nothing about that has changed in my whole career. And there have always been ups and downs when there have been changes in administration. But this is the first time that we have in my lifetime, adult career lifetime, actually seen a situation where not only do we have a great deal of flux around leadership, because we are changing from a Democratic leadership who are heading agencies to a more Republican oriented leadership mm-hmm. heading those organizations. Sure. That happens every time we have a major change in administration, whether it's every 4 or every 8 years. That always happens.
From one party to the next?
From one party to the next. Okay. That's not a change. What is also different this time, though, is that there's been significant federal employee layoffs mm-hmm. that impact who does what and how things are going to get done. and it's going to impact timing of a lot of things, schedules, et cetera. And there is a lot of interpretation going on right now in terms, or maybe I should say redefinition of terms, who it might be available to, who would be more likely to be considered a viable candidate for those funds.
Okay.
And what that translates to basically is there is a tremendous amount of anxiety in some groups, out and out fear about how those changes coming out of Washington, D.C. are going to have an impact. So some organizations receive federal funding. Mm-hmm. And a lot of federal funding passes through state capitals. For us here in Texas, it's got to go through Austin. It goes through the governor's office or some agency there, and then back out to the nonprofit.
Okay.
So even when that happens, there's all this shift going on from Washington to then the state capitol, and then what the state capitol leaders are going to do and how they're going to parse those funds out to the local organizations.
Gotcha. It's sort of like a funding supply chain logistics.
Absolutely. Yeah. So gotcha. With so much change going on, there's just a lots and lots of question about what's happening. And then part of why that impacts philanthropists is that as soon as nonprofit organizations get nervous about where their funding is going to come from, they start looking around for other buckets to go to for that funding. And so then that means an increased pressure on family foundations, corporate foundations. They're all going to see a increase in request in the next year or two, just because organizations are going to start trying to cover their bases.
The increase in those requests to private funding versus government funding. Do you think that that shift in requests and attention, is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Or is it just like, that's a reality? It's neither good nor bad.
It's definitely a reality. It will seem bad or a negative for some, because if I'm a nonprofit organization and I haven't really done much research to find out what foundations are interested in the work I do, then you're starting on the back foot. You're not able to just launch right out and go looking. Some private foundations are trying to step back a little bit because they're anticipating that there's going to be an increase in requests. So they're trying to figure out, do we need to be a little bit more specific about what we fund and don't fund? They're actually taking on maybe a wait and see what the administration does and how it affects state and federal funding. And then we'll figure out how to come in alongside. So you've kind of got all of that going on, which is why the fear level is rising, because nobody has answers.
Gotcha. Yeah. So really it's just that uncertainty of, will this be good? Will this be bad? I have co-opted from somebody, I don't know who to give attribution to, but the saying of nonprofit is a tax status, not a growth strategy. So nonprofits are businesses. In the end of the day, they're businesses. Do you think some of the fear is mostly from those nonprofits that maybe they were like teetering on the brink, they weren't as healthy, maybe they weren't as skilled at managing cash flow or some of those things? Like, when those things happen for the business community, when supply chain logistics, like take COVID for example, upset a whole lot of businesses, restaurants, all these different things, those that had some of these things, they were prepared, or they had diversified, they weathered the storm. It still hurt, but they weathered the storm, they pivoted, they found new avenues, and then they got to come out on the other side. Would you say that that's similar here, or is it something else?
Wow, such a good question. I think it's something else. There are similarities to what we experienced during the COVID period. in that all came as such a shock, and no one had been through a situation where there was a shutdown everywhere. It impacted all of us, not equally, but certainly everyone was impacted. Part of what's really, really different about this is that we have for, in this country, I'm going to say the last 20 years, and in an increasing level in the last decade, a move toward equity and way beyond what it means to have equality of services, but actual equity of services, which takes us to a really new level. And we're at a point where the definition of minority groups has expanded significantly. It doesn't just mean color or ethnicity anymore. So because of that, over this last decade, especially really seeing ramp-ups in the expectation that when organizations are applying for funding, that they will make sure that they address how their services are serving all people. So the shift right now that has gone on politically is to move what feels like to many people, to many groups, light years away from where they thought they were, which was that they had finally reached a place where their voices were heard and there was more fairness for sure in how funding was passed on and who it was passed to. Part of why this is different is because this is a mindset change. If I'm the grant writer and I have been writing grants for many years, aiming to get funders to fund us for the services we provide, I have learned how to write those grants using the right words.
Mm-hmm.
But this change is actually significant enough that it is saying, we actually want to remove words. We actually want to say there are certain words that are too hot to use. They would be targeted in some way. They would create a negative response at the federal level, for sure. And potentially what would happen is that as money moves from Washington down to the local capitals, there will be strings attached that say you cannot fund certain things with this money. And if that happens, then it continues right on down to the local level. So I think for many, it's regardless of what the services are, or how they've been delivered, it's sitting back and going, okay, now how are we going to tell our story? What words are we supposed to use? What words should we not use right now? Because the administration has become hypersensitive to a negative reaction, a negative response to serving certain groups of individuals or organizations that serve particularly ideologies and thinking.
Sure.
So it's super complicated and messy, just about the messiest thing I've seen.
But as you were saying before, like when we switch which political party might be in power, the language that you use, what they're looking for changes. People have had to make this shift, and we just got to tailor the same thing. Like we've talked about this as being speakers at conferences and summits and things like that. I have some core topics, but there's usually a theme or something like that, and that they're looking to align with. And I'm like, oh, well, that's a new lens by which I can reinterpret my content and say, yeah, it does align this way. I might actually highlight a different element at this conference than I would at that. So I have my core topic, and then I reinterpret it based on how it might align over here. How is this really any different than just saying, hey, they're looking for something different, so we got to write it differently? Is it, at its essence, is it anything more than that?
At its essence, that is what it is. Many people, though, will feel like they have been damaged and hurt in some way and have lost ground. So there's it has many layers. We're going to hear about this for a long time.
Sure.
But let's move a little bit in the direction of what's the immediate answer that an organization or a philanthropist can be thinking about to address a time that is super messy, because we simply are in it. We're living in it. So
we can only control what we can control, right?
That's right. So we can only do what we can do right now, right where we are, right in the local community that we're in or the organization that we work for. and think that quite often in the nonprofit community, there's been an increasing understanding that, like you said, nonprofits are a business. And in the last 20 years or so, nonprofits have begun to operate and act more business-like. 1980s and 90s, there's been this moving shift, but we're definitely much more into that today than we were in the past. Even though nonprofits might spend some time doing some strategic planning, their boards are more keen to budgetary issues and that sort of thing today than they might have been a decade or so ago. What I don't see nonprofits do well, which I think would be useful right now, is that they don't really take advantage of scenario planning. Most of the time when boards or board of directors come together for a nonprofit meeting that they're on and they hope to get in and get out and be done with that meeting within an hour and a half, it's full of all kinds of reports and everybody needs to see and everybody needs to understand. But some of the most important work that a board needs to do is thinking, planning, asking the tough questions, and scenario planning goes even a further step, which is to say, let's propose a couple of things that could happen and then go ahead and plan out or think about what we would do and actually take time to do that. And I think if nonprofits could really make themselves plan time with their board of directors to start that kind of thinking, that it would help them get on the front foot instead of being on the back foot. And don't just wait to hear how the request for proposal from Washington or from the state capitol. Don't just wait for that to come. Yeah. Go ahead and think now, what would you do if, and get a little more prepared.
Gotcha. Yeah, there's a lot of probably analogies and stuff that we can make. But it makes me think of just like normal relate, like in relationships, like the worst time to discuss a really critical issue is like in the midst of an argument, like with your friend or your partner or something like that. That's not the time. Like it may be top of mind right then, but you're in all of your feelings, there's fear, there's anger, there's all the mix. Not going to come out right, and you're not going to make sound decisions. Nobody ever made a great decision when they were angry or afraid. But saying, hey, like we might see something coming up, or we just know that this is something that is common to our particular realm of nonprofits, right? Because nonprofits aren't just a big old collection. Like they have their almost like sub niches in there. And so it's creating a, if this happens, then we do sort of planning, right?
Yes.
Who should be leading that? Is that and I'll hype you up, bring in Dawn. Should organizations be bringing in a third party like you or me or someone else that does this sort of work? Is this something that a particular subcommittee, like I just got named to run my governance committee, which means I should probably give you a call because I'm just making it up. Or is that the president? Is that everybody together? What does that look like? And who's the catalyst for that sort of planning and thinking and introducing those ideas?
I think the catalyst is potentially the board president or chair. At a minimum, it should be the executive director who is thinking, should always be thinking forward. So between the two of them, if they're not doing it, then certainly a board member just needs to say, hey, time out, guys. Let's talk about how we're going to be prepared for the future. So in other words, there's anybody on the board can raise their hand and basically say, we need to do some planning if they don't hear it coming from the actual two leaders of that board and that organization. And board members should not wait in silence. They'd be thinking we should be doing this, and they shouldn't be having a meeting out in the parking lot saying, when are we going to get around to doing this? It needs to come out in the board meeting. Say it. Right. Don't keep it to yourself. Right. Now, who is best to actually do that kind of scenario thinking? It is always helpful, in my opinion, to have an outside facilitator help an organization to think through this. It's the same with a private foundation whose board may be trying to think about how are we going to handle a whole lot more requests than we may have ever had. the outside facilitator is objective, is able to help guide the group through the discussion and toward some decision-making that they may need to do in a very healthy way. The outside facilitator plays a role in that they don't have a, they don't have a dog in the hunt. You know, right. It's not their issue. And so they should be able to bring that objectivity to it. Now, all of that said, you don't have to have an outside facilitator. If there's a strong board member who is very comfortable sort of leading a group, for instance, Kenny, you sit on your board and you have a lot of presentation skills and leadership skills. And so they could say, hey, we just want Kenny to lead us through some discussion. And I would also say, some boards might have a tendency to think we've got to get everybody together for a 3 or 4 hour meeting, and that's hard to do. Or just simply carve out dedicated time on the next 4 board meetings for that topic and stop the rest of it and very specifically go in for 20 or 30 minutes and unpack the questions. And so maybe one meeting you identify 4 critical questions. And then at the next meeting, you start unpacking those so that then you could make a plan. It doesn't have to be done in long board retreats and the what's called iterative work of board literally massaging and packing and unpacking stuff. Mm-hmm. That's the core of their work. And so to make that part of the board agenda is absolutely a perfect way to do it. The other way is the outside facilitator.
Gotcha. Yeah. And one of the other benefits of an outside facilitator, this sounds like I'm selling myself, but if you are part of the board or part of a group, being facilitator and participant,
you can't do both.
Not well, at least. And that, so sometimes just having the ability for everyone to be fully engaged as a participant can net you a bigger benefit towards your outcome. Because at the end of the day, you're there for outcomes.
That's right.
And I love the iterative piece because it sounds like there's a great saying that I love, which is it's not what you decide, it's that you decide. So what I hear you saying, if I were to translate it, it's not what you do, it's that you do something, right? The worst thing would just be saying, we should do something about this, and then never really taking action. And then situation sneaks up on you and you're totally unprepared simply because it never moved past the ideation phase, right?
Right.
Never really activated people to get the ball moving and execute. With that sort of planning, and you can't, I don't hear you saying that you should plan for every contingency, right? There's just some stuff that's going to sneak up and bite you in the butt.
That's right.
Are there some core areas that you, in your experience and with the coaching consulting you do now, that you're like, these are some of the core gaps that I see people aren't prepared, they aren't planning, they aren't even a simple, let's formally acknowledge that this could affect us and even just have an outline or simple that would be our response. It may not be a detailed like crisis response plan in a handbook, but at least have something. Where most often are those gaps occurring for nonprofits or even the family foundations?
So at the nonprofit level, a lot of times organizations just simply don't stop to talk through what if a particular funding source goes away. And it doesn't matter whether it's state and federal funding or it's a grant. You know, it could be that there's a foundation that is a significant supporter year over year of the work that the organization does. But sometimes funders just up and decide to do things differently and in very unexpected ways. They don't announce it. Very seldom do they announce it. And so once an organization is getting, I don't know, say 25% or more of their funding from one particular source, I would say it is a really good idea to have a conversation about what if we lost that 25% source? It wouldn't matter what it is. What would we do and how would we address it? So,
is that a good benchmark for nonprofits? Because it gets talked about whether 20 to 25% in a lot of the business books and stuff that I've read or conversations I've had is don't let any one client or source account for more than this, because it yeah. creates a dependency that could, if they changed it like that, like yeah. you said, then that produces a lot of instability in your organization. So is 25% a good rule of thumb?
Probably.
I know there's no science.
Yeah, the 20 to 25%, like you said, is probably very safe. In the business world, a business is lucky to get anywhere from 10 to 20%. It's actually profit after the net comes out. So for those of us that work just by ourselves, it's not very different. You're hoping to break even and cover all your expenses, your living right. expenses, your family expenses, whatever they are. Yeah. And you hope for a little bit over and above. So that those numbers are, I think, pretty similar regardless of who we're talking about. From the private foundation side of it, I think a private foundation board having a conversation about whether or not their funding focus, if they have focus areas, whether that needs to be broadened or changed. And that is going on right now all over the country with very large foundations that fund things. They're having to take a look at what they fund to make decisions about whether they're going to ramp up in some areas to absorb the change that they see coming from the federal level. That's leading to a lot of very important conversation that sometimes foundation boards don't have, but it's important that they have it.
I'm curious, what percentage of nonprofits do you think have a funding source that accounts for over 25% of their annual funding?
What percentage? Oh gosh, yeah, I would really be guessing. I know that number's out there.
Do you think it's the majority?
I'm not going to say it's more than 50%, but I'm going to say it's somewhere between 35 and 50%. It's still a broad range, but it's a significant number because as nonprofits get going, if they can find fairly large buckets to draw from, they tend to get reliant on those, and they ignore the importance of growing the base of individual donors, which can be what gets you through super challenging situations like this.
I would think finding those, whether it could be foundations, which are sort of personal, but sort of like a grant, more like an institution granting something funds, but people who really are connected with, passionate about the mission. Because I wouldn't say, even if you're getting funds from state or federal, it's not necessarily like they're passionate connected with it. There was that was part of legislation or something else. Therefore, they're obligated to have a submission and deadline and all the logistics that come with it. But the people who really are like, yes, absolutely, we love this, we care about this, we want to make a difference in this way, it sounds like those are the people that get you through the tough times, that they may be more stable, dependable sources of funding. And so it sounds like it might be a better idea for nonprofits to really lean into acquiring, expanding, retaining those sources, as opposed to just, not that we'll just call government, at whatever level, government level of funding is bad, but maybe not as dependable.
Yeah, if you looked across the country, there's probably less than 30% of the nonprofits across the country that actually get, say, federal funding. A little bit more than might get state funding, but it includes some pass-through Fed dollars. But the reality is most nonprofit organizations are relatively small. They rely on the local community, whether it's their special event driven or they are individual donors. The United Ways across the country making a big difference there. Corporate support. At any rate, really and truly, there's a lot for most organizations. It's the community that gets them through anyway. And
just like the small business community, right? Like most small businesses have less than five people in them. And that makes up 90% of businesses in the U.S.
Yes. And so part of what is a little concerning here is that those small nonprofit organizations that are very community oriented, both in their services and in their donor support, or not what I would consider terribly sophisticated in their management or their board leadership or governance, but they have what they need. It works for them. They have what they need. The larger nonprofits that can get funding from the federal government or from the state, or a little more organized, stronger boards, stronger leadership, may have more, know more people in the community. Now, when they start hitting their local foundations for funding because they're losing dollars, the competition just ramped up at a very, very unlevel playing field.
Because they've got the resources to apply in more places. They've probably, like,
they know more people.
They've got the political, I say political capital, just as relate, maybe a substitute relational capital.
Yes. Yes.
Which you can go back to, I don't like the saying, but your network is your net worth sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that plays in both for-profit, non-profit worlds.
Yes.
Who you know is almost as, if not more important than what you know. I've been on both sides of that. Benefited and been not, I'll just say not benefited from that. So they've entered the fray into the communities. What can these smaller nonprofits do, or how should they be thinking? And that's probably the better question, because you mentioned the biggest shift is the mindset shift that needs to happen. Right. You got to be aligned with your reality. Like we can complain and bemoan changes outside of our control all day. And that's just life. What is the mindset shift? These maybe smaller nonprofits that are, they're trying to come up, right? They want to make bigger impact. How can they be shifting that mindset, or how should those leaders be thinking about it so that they are uniquely positioned to be supported by individuals, foundations, organizations that truly care about their cause?
This is why I love the name of your podcast, How Leaders Think, because size does not keep you from having a really robust thinking style. Okay. So just because
I'll pay you the $20 for that endorsement later.
Just because you're a small nonprofit doesn't mean that you can't carve out time on your agenda to think about the future. We tend to think that the organizations with larger, stronger boards, they're going to be more business-minded, and they're going to do all that. There's nothing to keep the very small nonprofits from emulating and modeling after what a larger nonprofit does. And if they will do that, then they will take some really important steps forward that will help them to not just be more prepared for what changes might happen, but how to be more assertive, more outgoing, more confident, more intentional about how they go about making their services known not just to those who need the services, but to those who support organizations that are providing those services.
This makes me think a lot of, like, with my first company, which was a digital marketing agency, but I do some of this work now around positioning. Like businesses, because obviously we're in a capitalistic society and it's like survival of the fittest, which, by the way, I like and appreciate, and it does give the smaller guys and gals a fighting chance to, like, if you really get it right and level up your skills, you too could go and launch a business that provides, puts food on the table. Maybe it's not a $1 billion unicorn, but you could do that. But, and I know you and I have talked a little bit about this, of just amongst nonprofit coaches, consultants, professionals, how do you stand out and not say this is basically become a commodity? How can nonprofits stand out and say, here's the unique place in our community? Because most of them, like you said, they're starting out, they're very local, geographically focused on a particular problem. Now, that problem may exist somewhere else, but they're focused on this first community that they live in initially. So that is a marketing, technically speaking, it could be a marketing thing. I put it on a strategic plan that I coach my clients and other people on is you've got to know what you're the only at. There's something called an onlyness statement, which comes from Marty Neumeier's book, Zag. So if you want to go and pick that up, it's a really fast read for anybody listening. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. But that's the part that I have found in talking to nonprofits that they struggle just like any other business, but sometimes feels like maybe they feel less of an impetus to really nail that down, to which I respond, I was like, nobody owes you money based on the passion you have for your cause. That you have to have that, don't get me wrong, but it's on you to clearly tell that story and for that story to stick out amongst all the other millions of stories out there. Would you agree or disagree with that? Obviously, I'm newer into the community and the world, so you may be like, all right, young pup, calm down. And that's cool too. But is that sort of like what you're seeing, what you're getting at, or even what with all of your work with philanthropists and people trying to get funding, that you're like, you've got to tell something unique. You've got to not just be another Me Too nonprofit. Oh yeah, we also help those people. Then I'll give my dollars to the one that's bigger because they're more noticeable and it seems like they're quote unquote better run, even though you and I both know that's not necessarily the case.
The challenge for the philanthropist that is not well understood by nonprofits is how easily we're confused. And I will use children's services as an example. If I ask you what's the difference in your local court-appointed special advocates and your children's advocacy center, both having the word advocate or advocacy in their title, would you know what the difference is? Well, then you'd say, well, no, maybe they sound really similar. So I'm not going to look at their mission statement. Now I look at their mission statement and they're both serving children. They're both going to court somehow or another. They're both trying to deal with abusive situations for children. But the truth is that between those two agencies, one of them works in the civil court and one of them works in the criminal court.
So how would you know that from just the initial stuff you might find in a brochure or the website?
Yeah. And so a lot of times, many times, nonprofit organizations describe or frame what they do without a real understanding of how similar they sound to two or three other nonprofits in the community. And so when you talk about telling a story, I mean, marketing, understanding marketing is really a big deal to making sure that you are telling your story in a way, as you said, that's not only unique, but is clear. And does away with the blur. Because what philanthropists do when the picture is blurred is just back away.
It could be blurry, or there's just, you're like, I've got six organizations that they all seem to do the same thing.
I got
to
pick who do I have lunch with? Who do I?
Right. And
who do I see at church every week?
Then it becomes just like a recency bias. You pick the path of least resistance at some point because decision fatigue sets in. You're worn out and you're like, this one seems like the best candidate. Or I, you know what? I liked the lunch where I had tacos better than the one where I had spaghetti. I'm going with the taco person. Like, I know that that's a comical example, but that probably has happened at least once. Just for the record, if you want any of my limited resources for your nonprofit, tacos over spaghetti, just putting that out there. But no, I love that because I do something similar, whether it's with a mission statement or when I do work with core values, there's almost a tendency, this is across any organization, but I think nonprofits fall victim to this more often. Patrick Lencioni says that there are like three like core values traps, is that they're aspirational. They're who we would love to be, but aren't currently today, which is not the right place for values. They're permission to play. So I tease this and step on toes intentionally, but like we value honesty and integrity. And I'm like, yeah, but do you think that anybody else values lying and duplicitousness? No, they don't. So yes, of course, we want honesty and integrity. Or they, if your nonprofit or your organization has been around for a while, they're the ones that no longer serve you. Like we were this at the beginning. We've grown up since then. Like maybe we've been in business 20 years. The values should reflect our current state. But what usually gets people is if I wiped your logo off of your core values or your mission statement and took it into, say, like in your example, like between those two entities, and I walked in and I said, hey, is this your mission? Are these your values? And I was like, how likely are they to say, okay, yeah, that's ours. That's totally ours. I was like, then they're not uniquely yours and don't tell the story of you. It just sounds like word salad. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't sound bad, but it sounds like everybody else. And then you become noise instead of signal. Mm-hmm. And I say that knowing full well how difficult it is to unearth what makes you different. I'm still wrestling with this for my own coaching practice. And by the way, it's so much easier for me to do this. I could do it in 10 seconds for another entity, but it'll take me 10 years to figure it out for myself. And I really hate that. But where do people lean in to, I've got to distinguish myself. And I think that this trickles all the way back to the beginning of our conversation, which is there's instability in funding currently in our country. There's a lot of fear and uncertainty. You're going to have to, your people, groups, teams, grant writers, grant makers, everybody's reconsidering, where do we apply? Where do we diversify our sources of funding and revenue and income? Now we've got to go out and tell our story. And not only do we have to be compelling in new markets or to new people, we might also be going up against some pretty established heavy hitters. And so I think it is an opportunity. I think everything's an opportunity, right? Like you can choose, me, or opportunity for me to learn and grow and do something different and innovate. If somebody said is facing this, what you've said today really resonates with them. They're like, yeah, Don, that's me. We're overbooked on this particular source. We don't feel certain that it'll continue, but we don't want to wait to find out. How do people start planning and telling their story? Because I think we had a couple of great ideas in here, but someone wants to take action. They're spurred. Maybe they're a board member. They could be an executive director. Next 24 hours with little to no money, how could they get started towards building a more secure future for themselves?
So I think that the nonprofit executive director and or the president should grab each other and sit down and have a conversation about how are we going to work this conversation into our very next agenda in order to at least get the board to begin thinking that we need to plan for a future in a little bit more intentional way than we have been. And that it's the board's responsibility to do that. We can't just rely on the executive director to come and tell us where all the funding opportunities are. So we have to lean in as a board to think this through. So I think the most immediate next step is find the other person on that board that one or the other need to be talking to, and then figure out how to get it on the media agenda. From there, I think that in the philanthropy world, that foundations that are realizing that it's possible they'll see more requests than they ever have, that in a similar way, they need to not just wait till the end of the year to make all their decisions. They may need to, because it's not unusual, especially for very small foundations to do that, they may need to carve out time now to make some plans about what they will fund or not fund, or whether they're going to have some emergency funding that they're going to utilize for nonprofits. A real important question that that private foundations have to, or that often wrestle with, is whether they'll, during situations like this, dip into their assets, or they're only going to give the required amount that the IRS requires. Really large foundations have those conversations much more often. simply because of the level of their assets and because of the level of planning and thinking that they do. Small foundations simply need to do similar work and go ahead and ask themselves some of those same questions so that everybody in a particular community can be prepared for how to work together on all of this. It's just like the saying that all politics is local. I know it's messy what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now, but the truth of the matter is what we do right here in the community we live in or where your listeners are living, what's happening in their communities right now and their response and how to act and react to all of this together is the solution, not waiting.
Yeah, taking that the sort of proactive approach. And truth be told, for most people, what happens at the local level will affect their day-to-day lives far more than certain things that may happen at the federal level. Not that it doesn't, but it may be a greater, more immediate impact at that local level, like where you're living. Don, this was a great conversation, and I think we could have kept going, and we'll just save those for next episodes. Right. But I do want to highlight the fact you have two books. If anybody is interested in reading and learning more from Don, and if you don't, then what's wrong with you? Talk about those two books. And then if somebody would love to connect with you, learn more about you and your work and your consulting practice, where you'd send them.
So yes, there are two books. One of them is The Gift of Giving, which is a book that can be bought at my website, dawn@dawnfranks.com. It's about exploring your stories and your own personal giving legacy, regardless of whether you have a lot to give or just a little bit to give. Mm-hmm. The second book is Giving Fingerprints, and it is an ebook which is free and available, again, at the website for anybody to be able to download and look at. I have a personal belief that we all have unique giving attributes. Which is what I call fingerprints. And when you put all of those values together of what is important to us about our giving, that once we know those, we can sharpen and be our giving and be more impactful. And so those books are targeted toward that message.
Which I really like. And that was how we met, was going through the exercise of understanding that. It really is fantastic. So y'all go download the books. We'll have the links and everything in the show notes. You mentioned your email address, dawn@dawnfranks.com, and then we'll also have your LinkedIn profile connected up there. So if anybody wants to reach out and be your LinkedIn friend. Connection. It's a business platform. Whatever.
Yes.
But thank you so much. I hope to have you back in the future. Listeners, if you made it this far, thank you. I hope you really enjoyed the conversation and got something out of it. And you're actually going to take action on what Don instructed, because I want to entertain you, because we don't need boring podcasts. But I also want this to be something that gives you ideas for how to improve your leadership and your journey. One way you can pay that forward is by liking, rating, reviewing, subscribing. Engagement helps this show up to more people in more places. And your simple act could help somebody stumble across this at just the right moment and unlock the next step on their journey. And so it's a free and easy way for you to pay it forward. And won't that feel good? Just like down in your heart, your soul, your gut, I don't know, wherever you feel things. But until next time, change the way you think, you'll change the way you lead.